This is the Counter Up Rugby podcast brought to you by the Irish Times in association with Nifty Business. My name is Nathan Johns and I'm joined by regulars Gordon Darcy and John O'Sullivan. And later on in the show, we've got a very special guest. It's former Leinster back row Shane Jennings. Shane played for both Leinster and Leicester, who are, of course, the opponents in the Champions Cup this week. And he had a very memorable stint over in Leicester with Leo Cullen. The two of them came back to the province and took everything that they had learned from a European Cup winning outfit. We're coming to you today, 24 hours later than usual, after working both bank holidays during the Six Nations period. We decided to give ourselves Easter Monday off so John could eat lots of chocolate. But what did happen on Easter Sunday, John, is you were at the RDS for Ireland women's narrow defeat to Italy in the Six Nations.
Yeah, I mean, Ireland dominated territory and possession initially. They were obviously a player up at one stage when they got their penalty try. They didn't maximise that. And that was to kind of came back to haunt them a little bit towards from about the 20th minute on. When you don't take your opportunities, and they didn't take enough of them, and they had enough opportunities, that was the other thing. So if you're looking at it from an Irish perspective, you said, yeah, we created some opportunities. But then some of the sharpness went out of that game. Some of the decision-making was a little bit flawed. They allowed Italy back into the game. And Italy showed them that with good passing skills, how you can open up teams. So if you've got, from an Irish perspective, if you've got Bevan Parsons on a wing, you try and get the ball to her. While fixing the inside defence, you try and get the ball to her early enough. But Ireland, she was faced by about four defenders most of the time. She did remarkably well. And I think you've a stat that says she beat more defenders than anybody else.
Nine defenders, most in the game.
But that is important, isn't it? It's not like, in so many ways, it's not just about getting a player the ball. It's getting them ball that they can do something with. Yeah. Like, she is a Rolls Royce of a player. Yeah. She is incredible. Ability to beat players, her ability to create moments, everything like that. But you give, compared to like somebody like Cheslin Kobe, somebody like that who is, give him ball on the back foot, and yeah, he's not going to be able to do anything. Same with Bevan Parsons. Like, to have somebody like that, you either need to do one of two things. You either need to improve how the ball is being delivered to her, or you need to find new ways to get her on the ball where the ball isn't on the inside shoulder or there's four defenders around her.
Yeah. I think the reason why she beat so many defenders is because, like you said, she was swarmed nearly every time she got the ball. For the first 10, 15 minutes aside, like you said, when Italy were down to 14 after the penalty try that put Ireland up.
The positional play from the Italian fullback was, I couldn't find her.
The penalty try, is it?
Yeah, no, sorry. She was in bin, but then when she was on the pitch, some of where she was standing on the pitch, there was so much space in the outer channel. So if you got the ball there or kicked the ball there, there was plenty of space. It was just a question of appreciating that and getting it there quickly enough. So I think the points that are made are well made. It's if you have Eve Higgins, Bevan Parsons, you've got to give them a little bit of time and space. And if you can do that, then Ireland will benefit from an attacking capacity. I think Ireland got to a point where the intercept had a huge impact on the end game. So Katie Corrigan intercepted. Italy were running the ball out of their 22, and she did really, really well. And she intercepted, and they got 7 points from that. And then all of a sudden, there was a new sense of belief. The only problem was they were beaten by the clock in some respects. A fantastic penalty kick to the corner by Dan O'Brien. She'd done it twice, I think, or once before in the match. And they had the perfect platform to try and rescue an unlikely win. But the question for Ireland, the players and the management team, is to look at the game as a whole and say, right, we almost pulled a victory out of the bag in the end. But for large tranches in the middle of that match, they just weren't good enough in an attacking capacity. They just need to be better, basically.
Well, I tell you what, it's interesting. 7 line breaks for Ireland versus 3 versus Italy. 301 metres after contact for Ireland versus 200 for Italy. Like, those stats aren't even close. But also, what's not close is Ireland coughed up the ball 22 times and Italy coughed it up 14 times. So that's kind of it in a nutshell. Lots of endeavour, lots of good go-forward ball at times, particularly when Italy were down to 14. But just far too many mistakes.
Sam Monaghan didn't deserve to lose. If you look at Sam Monaghan, Aoife Wafer, the way they carried the ball, the impact they had in the game, even Behaven Parsons. And I know she'll be disappointed with the pass that kind of floated a little bit in the breeze. She needed to step in and catch it, and it would have been a try. But they gave Ireland plenty of, they gave them a platform to play. The problem was they didn't take those opportunities. And if you contrast that with the Italian passing, so if you look at Italy's tries, the offloading and the passing out in front and getting the ball quickly to the people that can score. So Italy maximized their scoring opportunities pretty much. And I know their hooker Vicini got a couple of tries, but they took their opportunities. And for Ireland, the reflection on that game will be, well, they didn't take enough of them. And that's something that they need to improve on going forward. It's not all doom and gloom. Some of the rugby that they played, some of the ideas that they have are good. And you can see what they're trying to do. It just needs to get better quicker.
I'm glad you mentioned Monaghan, because her work rate was astonishing. Rugby Pass have got an interesting stat on their website, and it carries per minute, and she's basically nearly averaged a half a carry for every minute. So, you know, you can do the maths there, and that's an incredibly high workload. The next Irish player was Aoife Wafer with 0.28 carries per minute. You mentioned there she didn't deserve to lose, probably just didn't have anyone else supporting her on those tight carries on the inside, and their other best carrier, Aoife Wafer, was told to be that one forward in the wide pod, and she just hugged the touchline all day. And probably you just almost need someone to say, you're carrying brilliantly when you get the ball, come in and look for the work, because we're not going to get you the ball out there enough. And that brings us onto what I'd love to talk about more, is kind of like an experience point of view. Like, someone sent me a text the other day saying Sam Monaghan's only been playing rugby, like adult rugby, for 4 years. It looks like that Irish side, you know, that nobody was there to grab Wafer by the scruff of the neck and say, come in, you're our second best carrier, do something, you know, get on the ball more. And they just needed that little bit more.
Yeah, well, leadership. There's an experience piece there as well for the player, which will come, you know, if you're only 4 years into the game. But this is the problem when you coach the systems. It doesn't matter which, if you're playing men or women's sport, if you're looking for a system, not an opportunity, that's what you end up with. You have players looking to go, okay, well, we play a three pod off the 10. So you're building that shape before the defense is even set, which, you know, it is what it is.
That's a very good point. If you contrast that with Italy appreciated where the space was in the pitch, and they got the ball to where the space was. So they played with it more of a heads up style, because they had less possession, we'll say, less territory, but they maxed out in terms of taking their chances. I think also for Sam, if she had her time again, that penalty, which was a gimme three, she hands the ball to Dana, and it was a strong breeze. For those who weren't there, it was a very strong breeze, and Dana was in the center of the pitch, and she tried to kick it into the corner, and she did it brilliantly in the second half with the wind on two occasions. She maxed with two brilliant kicks, but this time she didn't make the touchline. And she wasn't alone, because the Italian out half suffered the same, Media, I think is her name. She suffered the same problem. So in those circumstances, you look at it and say, right, okay, are we on the margins here? And we'll just take the 3 points, go back and go again, basically.
Well, Italy went down and scored. So the difference there is, it was 7-5 to Ireland at that point. If you kick it in front of the post, it's 10-5. Whereas like 2 minutes later, it's 7-12. And then there was another moment, I think, where there was a similar in the second half. And you're talking about 14-point swings there, which, you know, that's massive in a game of 6 points. So they get a week off now in the Women's Six Nations before they return in a fortnight. Lots of provincial action this week as well. Leinster beat the Bulls on Friday night. Connacht lost to Benetton in a kind of a last-minute heartbreak. Isacore scored in the corner. Richie Murphy and Ulster went close against the Stormers, but they lost, and Munster saw off Cardiff at the weekend in Thomond. What took your eye from those four games over the weekend?
Probably, I think the Munster one was very... Game was very interesting, because they did their best to struggle against Cardiff. Now, Cardiff, I thought, were one player short of being really, really good. I think, you know, the club rugby there looks pretty good. You can see Mason Grady was pretty good. Winners at 15. You could just see if they had one more player, maybe, you know, a really nailed on number 10 that could really control the game. They've got a bit of size up front. They could have been, they look like a team that could actually develop over the next couple of years. Munster just kind of huffed and puffed and struggled.
They got dominated at the breakdown, didn't they? I think Jenkins was there for Cardiff. He did an outstanding job back from injury. He missed the Six Nations, didn't he? But he had an absolutely outstanding day out disrupting Munster's ball.
I think it's a good lesson for Munster. I think it's a positive one when you win, is that you get a wake-up call for Sunday's game against Northampton Saints in Europe, that you need to protect the integrity of your breakdown ball. So Munster should appreciate that they needed to commit some more numbers, and the fact that Ellis Jenkins got into their breakdown so much, turned over ball, he wasn't alone either, means that it's something that Munster will get right for next Sunday. So they won a match in the URC and they should get it right for next Sunday. So it's a kind of win-win in that situation. If they don't, well, then they've nobody else to blame as far as they're concerned. I think Cardiff are a good side. I think the important thing for Munster is they found a way to win. That was important for them. Some of the performance, it still jars a little bit. I think some aspects of the performance turned over, you know, basic errors, snatching at stuff. You would expect them to be a little bit more composed because they're a side that play together a lot. They have a lot of their first choice players playing. And I think in those circumstances, it's a little bit, you know.
They missed RGE a lot.
Yeah.
Like, he adds a dynamic that is, in some ways it's unplayable. Like, he is going to guarantee you 5 to 6 offloads every game. And if it's in behind and you have players in the center or just people who people can respond to him. And you could see they looked like they were a little bit short on a couple of ideas.
Yeah, he was freakish last week against the Ospreys.
Well, he gives Gavin Coombs space. That's the other thing.
Exactly,
so yeah. when you can't double team, Cardiff could double team Gavin Coombs a lot because there weren't Munster players that were winning the collisions, enough collisions on the game line. So they could do that. And when you think of, like, Gavin Coombs is quite remarkable this season to have started every single game for Munster. That is some achievement for a number 8. So I think when Orji Snyman plays, it'll free up a little bit of space for him. If you free up space for him,
it's amazing the knock-on effect that players can have on others. And you will see the same thing when Bundy will come back into to Connacht, how he frees up players around him, the kind of 10 and the 13. It offers so much more. Exactly what John is saying. And same thing will happen now with Leinster as well. They'll just get players back in who just free up others around them.
Jack Rowley's first ever Munster try. I didn't realise he hadn't scored for Munster yet when he jinked over on the weekend. Some headlines saying for his competitive try, so I assume that means he scored in a pre-season friendly or something like that. But amazing that he hadn't actually crossed the line for his province yet. We'll talk about Leinster in a little bit more detail when we get our guest on after the break, but we should probably talk about the red card that wasn't from that game. Yet again, an incident where the officiating, not called into question, but lack of clarity, lack of consistency. It was a head-on-head collision, no arms. He kind of threw himself into Curtly Aronson in the Bulls game as he was in the act of scoring. I think everyone in the ground thought it was red, but miraculously it was yellow.
I can't remember who it was, whether it was the ref or the match official, that said majority of the force went through the shoulder or his chest. And that's, I think, what saved him for the red. But when I was watching it, I actually had to go back to it because did that actually happen? It's pretty hard to actually tackle like that. Like, that wasn't a tackle; it was a collision. He kind of ran into him, and then Aronson didn't step him or didn't dive for the corner, and just kind of braced for the contact, and then he just knocked into his head. It was a spectacularly poor technique.
Was McGrath lucky?
Totally. Oh yeah, yeah, absolutely. He was banged to rights. He was upright, so there's no effort to tackle per se in a.
It wasn't a tackle. It was a collision.
Yeah.
He just kind of ran into him.
And you could see that Arensa leans into him because he expects him to go lower or have a go at the ball. And he kind of, if you like, he grips the ball tighter. But yeah, no bend, no nothing. So it's not a tackle. It's a collision. I don't know how they arrived at the decision. It's not a good look for the game. I could understand what Luke McGrath was trying to do in some respects as he was trying to dislodge the ball. But if that had been the other way around.
But I don't think he was. I think, like, because you're looking at the body shape as he's coming in, he was running,
mm-hmm.
expecting Aronson to either go for the corner or to step him to come back in. And because he didn't, like,
point is over the line. I mean, it's either on the line or over the line. So there's no way that you think that you can stop him other than dislodging the ball because there's literally nothing else you can do.
So Aronson, he just braces for the contact and then McGrath's kind of caught between. He was like, oh, I was hoping you would do one of the other two and then just collides with him. It's breathtakingly bad.
I think if it was the other way around, the RDS crowd would have been going mad.
they were going mad for everything that night. There was offsides not given, apparently. And it was a very tetchy game, I thought, until the second half when Leinster did, you know, big shock horror. Nina Burr replaces the entire tight five.
It's been a bad couple of weeks for officiating, I would say.
Why'd you say that?
Well, just going back to the issues in the Gallagher Premiership as well.
Oh, that's,
you know,
the TMO.
TMO.
Sorry, Austin Healy's talking about this, so therefore I can't go look at it.
Oh no! And then this weekend where they got the yellow card wrong,
7 minute yellow card. Like,
and then I think he hit it. He cleared out a ruck or something close to the line.
He made a tackle and cleared out the ruck. Yeah, Stephen Lewis. Erne Herbst, I should say. Louis was the week before his tackle on Owen Farrell that caused the issues with Stuart Terhige.
It should be said that it's not a case of different jurisdictions, so to speak. I mean, it's the RFU.
It's just officiating in rugby.
But it's not a good look when you've got... Even the in the Leinster match, the Aaron's kick, when he glanced the back of the head of, I think it was one of the Byrne brothers, and that cost Aaron's a second try. Mm-hmm. Even that, like, you know... Once there's head contact, we're assumed that there's going to be a card of some description. And even though it was glancing and reckless rather than outwardly malicious, you think yellow rather than red. So I would have thought McGrath's was red and that was yellow, but that was penalty only. So it's confusing.
We're not at the point where these can be deemed rugby incidents yet. Like, the pendulum hasn't swung far enough. I suppose what I mean with that is hopefully we get to a point where players change their whole tackle technique and they tackle lower and the game is safer and we're seeing less upright tackles. We get to that point, occasionally there will be something will happen, there'll be a change of height, there'll be something will happen, incredible footwork, or just a player gets stuck in the ground and there will be accidental collisions and we'll be able to adjudicate for them. But we are way off that at the moment.
Houston now has got an option on side. Currently Aaron's for the corner. Bumping collision. Grinds the ball, the Bulls get
it. Jamie Osborne is definitely a highlight from the weekend. It's just, you know, watching him and Robbie Henshaw looked really good. But everything he does at the moment is just his ball distribution and his vision is fantastic. Look at him and watch how much he scans on a pitch. So for his brother's try, was it last week or the week before? He tells him to go back. He was coming around and you can see Jamie Osborne's looking and just goes, tells him to go back. And then, you know, the opportunity unfolds down the shorts. I think there's a lot to be excited about with him.
And he's 6'4" and 100 kilos. So he gets you that, he's that collision winner on the game line as well.
In team sport, in sport, you look for people who do the simple things very well. He does the simple things really well. He has that vision. He knows when to pass, when to hold on to the ball. And I think can be underestimated at times, particularly for a young player, that you understand those 50-50 calls in the heat of a match, in the maelstrom of a match, that you get those things right. He does it so well. The worry for Leinster this week is...
They have no centres.
Return to play.
Natai's 50-50, Henshaw's return to play, Ringrose we don't know. They're all... the bulletin went out yesterday, Monday. They're all to be assessed. So there's three centres there. So you would think Osborne's got a very good chance of featuring in a big European game.
I think he definitely will. Like, what you also say as well, just to make the point in relation to some of the younger players, that you ask players to kind of step up in matches and to kind of own the jersey for 80 minutes. And I think it's important to acknowledge that Rob Russell did that in an attacking capacity. Liam Turner has done that for his two cameos and players step up. Like, you know, there was pressure on. If you look at Max Deegan, Scott Penny's performances last week, suddenly this week, Jack Conan's man of the match. Josh van der Fleer scores a great try. So that's heartening for the Leinster coaches. It's great that that's the way players are stepping up when they get into the team and they're taking responsibility for their performances, which is what you want. And that's very important, particularly this weekend, which is...
But I think with Osborne, he's a player. So even if they're all injured, I think he is now established. So for Turner to come in, he can just concentrate on getting his stuff right in a Champions Cup game. That's a lot of pressure. And he can actually rely on the guy inside him. He's going to, even though he's experience-wise, he's such a quality player, he's going to take an awful lot of pressure on whoever comes in the 13. And if everybody is fit, you're now looking at Osborne as going, you need him on the pitch. So if there's a vacancy on the wing, get him on the field. He is now becoming that get him on the field type player.
I should have mentioned, Jordan Larmour as well. I mean, that's the other thing. Well. You ask somebody to step in. He stepped in. In Hugo Keenan's absence, and he played brilliantly going forward. So, you know, again, it's a positive in that respect. It'll be funny and tongue-in-cheek I'm mentioning this, that in November it'll be 3 years since Dan Kelly played for, he's got his one and only cap for England. He obviously played for the Irish 20s before that.
Dan Kelly of Leicester Tigers.
Of Leicester Tigers, who plays centre. So,
stop trying to start rumours, John.
I'm not. I also want to know where Oran McNulty is.
Oh, God, that just dropped. Oh, my goodness. A penny dropped.
Yeah, so there you go. Right, if he doesn't make the flight home, you know what's happened.
On that bombshell, we'll say goodbye to John. And after the break, myself and Gordon are going to be joined by former Leicester and Leinster man Shane Jennings. Welcome back to the Counter Ruck in association with Nifty Business. My name is Nathan Johns. I'm still here with Gordon Darcy, and I'm delighted to say that we're joined by Shane Jennings. Shane played for Ireland, Leinster and Leicester. And from 2005 to 2007, he took a brief hiatus to his Leinster career to go play for Leicester, who of course Leinster play this weekend in the Champions Cup. The two teams have a lot of history going back over the years. Most notably, Jennings and now Leinster head coach Leo Cullen, when they played for Leicester for those 2 years. After they returned to Leinster, they're largely credited with bringing back a winning culture that turned Leinster, perennial underachievers, into European champions, and they have only progressed since then. But Darce, let's start off with that history of Leinster and Leicester. I think you very helpfully pointed me in the direction of your first game against Leicester in the Heineken Cup back in 2002. There's a very interesting photo which you sent me of one Freddie Tuilagi, and he's handing you off as you're trying to tackle him. Now, you actually look a good bit taller than him in the photo. Is that because as he's handing you off, you're 3 inches in the air, or are you actually a good bit taller than the Samoan?
It's a little bit of both. Like that game in 2002 and playing against Freddie Tuilagi, and like our preparation was pretty much how do we stop Leicester Tigers at that stage. Our whole match was around, we didn't really focus too much on scoring tries, although we did with one with Dennis Hickey, and then Ben Willis scored just off the side of a mall. But it was all about, you know, how do we stop them? So I'd been repositioned, moved out from fullback to the wing, and was trying to rebuild my career at this stage. And was pretty much like, you know, Matt Williams was like, you know, you're playing, don't let him run over the top of you. That was like the sum total of the instructions.
Right, well, before I ask you how you got on, I want to read you a line that I found from the Guardian's match report of the day. And this is Rob Kitson. When Gordon Darcy has nightmares, it'll be Freddie Tuilagi's face he sees. And following yet another Samoan rampage down the left, Jordan Murphy shimmied over past a shattered defence. So it went well.
Yeah, well, I didn't get run over, if that makes any difference. But like when you're playing against a guy like that, you kind of, and you weren't given really much instruction, you kind of either have to be a guy who can stop somebody like that on the tackle line, which I absolutely couldn't do, or you figure out how to defend and you use the touch line, you use angles. He didn't make any line breaks, he didn't score any tries, but you had to give up a bit of territory. So yeah, as he was choking me, I did manage to slap it down and eventually kind of get him and fall on and get him down. So I think I did my job okay.
Do you have nightmares about him? Just to question Kitson's comment there. No. Is he the face you see when you see
No. There's okay. plenty of other scarier Tuilagis.
Yeah, plenty that played throughout the years. I can remember, I think was it 2011? I think you guys played them in the Aviva. Alisana was playing that day. He ran over a few people. I think that was a semi-final. Anyway, Shane, thank you so much for coming on and joining us. Looking at your career, Leinster, that kind of link. There's a story that when you played, you came off the bench, I think, against Leicester in 2005. And Leinster lost that day, as they did in 2002 in a Heineken Cup knockout game. But there's a story that Neil Back kind of basically recruited you there and then after that match to go over to Leicester the following season. Is that true?
I've heard that story. Whether it's true or not, I don't know. my sense is what probably happened was that Keith Gleeson at the time had a bad injury and wasn't playing. So when they were doing their prep for the game, they would have seen myself, Niall Roan, and obviously Keith probably earlier in the season that playing. And like any good opposition player, they were probably scouting of who they're going to come up against. So I think that's where it came from. But in essence, I don't know how true it is, but you'll have to ask Neil.
Okay, so he didn't come up to you on the side of the pitch. It's not one of those stories.
No, he didn't.
Okay. Right, because yeah, yourself and Leo Cullen, who's obviously Leinster's head coach now, went over to Leicester, what, that season? I think it was 2005 to 2007. You spent two years over there. I think it's an interesting one because if the narrative is you kind of left, got some experience, came back and Leinster's culture changing, whatever you want to call it, changed a little bit. For someone
of my generation growing up, it's kind of an alien concept. You have, you know, Jake White, the coach of the Bulls, was talking after the match on Friday about how everyone looks at Leinster's changing room, Leinster's environment, and how it's the gold standard, so to speak. It may or may not be, but to have people talking like that and think that there was a time less than 20 years ago where players would leave to kind of further their careers and a little bit, it seems like a little bit of an alien concept. So like what prompted your decision to go over there?
Well, I think from my point of view, it was a personal decision where between myself and the coaches and the management, I was fortunate where they wanted to give me a contract. I felt that there may not be the opportunity that I wanted it to be in terms of, was I going to be a starter or was I going to be able to compete? And did I put a value on my ability that they put a value on my ability, and went to market to see if there was an alternative, and Leicester was an alternative. Never in a million years did I actually want to go. And throughout the course of the negotiations, it just became more apparent that one side were probably more interested than the other. So it was a great opportunity for me to go to a club that was the standard bearer. Between Wasps themselves and Toulouse, they were probably the three teams in and around Europe, along with Munster, obviously, as well, the four teams that were winning the competition. Leicester winning English leagues and cups and competing on a high level. And obviously that generation of Johnson and all these kind of characters that were with the Tigers for years had set the foundations for the younger generation to come through. So yeah, I went over for 2 years. Leo followed me. He says he didn't, but he did. And then had great learnings. A completely different culture. Not to say that it was better or worse, but just very, very different. And from an outsider coming in, I could see all the benefits that they probably took for granted, and what the older generation had done. Leinster had a huge amount of talent, but I think we were probably in our infancy at the time of understanding what it was to be professional, what I'd understand to take the opportunity that was there. And Leinster were built on success, and guys like Jordan Murphy, I think, had probably won 5 or 6 league titles, a couple of Heineken Cups at that stage. So to go into an environment as a young fella with a bit of a chip on my shoulder was probably a good recipe for me to go over and learn. And good quality players internationally. You were talking about the two Alangis. Like, I think there was probably a squad of 40 and there was probably 25 internationals in that squad. So the level of talent, the English Premier League, you're playing week in, week out. So you had the opportunity to play against good players as well. Not that there wasn't in the Celtic League at the time, but just different. And you know, if you didn't learn, if you didn't pick up a few things along the way, you were a bit of a mug. And we stole a few ideas and we tried to bring them back. But it wasn't as if myself and Leo came back with a recipe book and said, oh, this is what we got to do. There was fellas like Gordon there and fellas like Dennis Hickey, like Gordon had mentioned, and Brian Shane and younger guys coming through that wanted to be successful in Leinster, and they were learning as well. And it wasn't one person or two people. It was the combination of all. And I was driven by Cheka, really, to be fair to him. He was the kind of people, or he was the person that was driving the standard. So a good combination of external learnings, a good combination of a big chip on a lot of people's shoulders, watching Munster do well and trying to be successful and take the opportunity that we felt that was there.
Doris, what was that environment like when he left? I mean, he's painted a picture there a little bit of a lot of talents, but inexperience. But from your point of view, first of all, was it a shock that kind of two players of that caliber were leaving? And what were they leaving at that stage?
Yeah, well, I think Jenna's been very kind of nice about it. Like, we were perennial underachievers, so we had all the talents, but ultimately couldn't get out of our way in knockout rugby. Jenna, who was the coach that you was there the year you left?
Deck Kidney.
Oh, Deck. Jesus, Deck Kidney. We're going through different coaches at this stage. We've had Gariella, we've had Declan Kidney, Michael Cheka about to be unleashed on us. Was it a surprise that they left? Not massively, because one of the things that sets, you know, when for you to be a good professional, you have to be competitive and you want to be starting. You know, you're never going to be okay with not starting. And, you know, Geno, you know, from the outside looking in, should have felt that he would have wanted more games in, you know, more starting time in that. So he went to a club, is there going, well, I might get a, you know, not to speak for him, to say might get a more fair crack at the whip. Because I would say probably at Leinster, there wasn't you probably selections weren't as, you know, necessarily based on performance all the time. Sometimes coaches had favours, and that was probably part of the problem we had in our culture, in our environment, was that, you know, players may not have always felt they got a fair crack at the whip.
Was it a case of, yeah, these guys are going over to the standard setters of European rugby? Yeah, go get your experience, go sort, you know, suit yourselves? Or was it still kind of like an insular, why are these guys leaving type thing?
You go back to that whole meeting that Kidney had in the Midlands with Ireland, and it's like Munster lads accused of wanting to play for Munster too much, and arguably Leinster lads wanted to play for Ireland more than they wanted to play for Leinster. I remember thinking about it going, it's a shame that they've gone, because I would have played with and against Shane at schools and everything coming up through, so I knew the type of player he was, and one of those players you always wanted on the field. So yeah, absolutely, you would have kind of, a bit of you going, you're sad to see them go.
Shane, what would you say was the biggest thing you took from that experience? You said, you know, everyone has a different way of doing things. There's no right or wrong way of doing it. But could you give us a little bit of insight maybe into what some of the differences were over there that you kind of took, that you looked at and you went, yeah, okay, I can see why they're doing that. And I like the way that they operate, be it in training, styles of play, culture, you know, even just as simple as winning trophies. Like what were those things that stood out to you?
Yeah, well, I think the main difference, and people have to appreciate this, that in Ireland, it's a different system with the centralized contracts and IRFU versus the English club system. I've never played in France, but the same principle. So when you're contracted to the Leicester Tigers, that's who you're contracted to. No, it's changed over the years somewhat with England as well. But on a Monday morning, you'd have Martin Carey there training, who's just played at the weekend or who's just been involved in England camp. And again, not that it's right, wrong or indifferent, but in Ireland, you didn't have that. So there was that kind of disjointed feeling at certain times of the season where the Irish players were off. The Leinster younger guys who wanted to be in that Ireland setup weren't there. So they were trying to improve and get into that system. Whereas, do you know what? At times the Irish lads came back and they probably weren't as hungry as they probably should have been to play for Leinster, Munster, Connacht or Ulster. Speaking part, I don't know if that was the case in other provinces, but in Leinster, do you know what I felt with? At times they could have pulled their head in, or do you know what? Was that me being selfish and jealous because the lads have been away and they're battered and bruised and they've just done well with Ireland? So it was that kind of difference in system initially. But the one thing that did stick out to me was a selflessness that I noticed from a lot of those players. And it wasn't just the likes of Martin Carey, it was everybody. And they had a very, very powerful culture in Leicester, that those English guys, just as well as the local guys, just as well as the lad from Rathfarnham, wanted to play for Leicester, because they made it very, very apparent that this is the most important thing here. And if you do well here, the outcome or the byproduct is you'll be successful. You'll get picked for wherever you're from or whatever it is. So I just remember, guys, on a Tuesday morning, the sessions were pretty physical. They were pretty intense and they were pretty well prepared for the Saturday game. And as an impressionable 23-year-old, 24-year-old, I thought it was a good way of approaching it. And I think when you looked from afar, you have an impression of an Austin Healey or a Lewis Moody or a whoever it might be. And when you actually spend time with them and you appreciate their expertise and their dedication, you go, do you know what? It's pretty impressive. And again, not that it's the right way of doing it. It was a way of doing things. And I felt that I was probably weak in certain areas where I could learn and develop and from that. So that's what I tried to do. And there was things that I felt that the guys in Leicester Tigers were a million miles off where the Leinster guys were, in terms of working on their skills and their appreciation for their skills, their appreciation for maybe some more of the finesse around the game. And I think the balance that Paddy Howard brought and the likes of Daryl Gibson and a couple of senior guys like that who had experienced different environments, it was a pretty powerful combination with the old school physical confrontational approach that Leicester had, with the finesse and with the ability to maybe develop a more attacking kind of platform that teams found very difficult to play against. And we had successful 2 years there because of that, you know. But it was the selflessness that I saw from the internationals and how that drove the younger guys to appreciate that this is the most important thing, and make sure that you do X, Y, and Z, because if you do you know what, the opportunities can come.
And Jenna, it's like, because you kind of hear these things from, you know, afar, the famed Tuesday sessions in Leicester. Like they were almost like things of, no other club kind of seemed to go at it, but it's that piece of, like, you have World Cup winners in there. You have guys, as you said yourself, you have players from, you know, that have stumped up in English camp and back in the straight day. It mattered to them as well. That was probably one of the biggest gaps in Leinster. Geordie often talked about the Tuesday night as well. which was something that wasn't always as talked about. There was like, and this bit I couldn't get my head around for ages as well, because you're trained to go, oh no, you don't drink at all, but you guys often opted for a few beers afterwards on the Tuesdays as well, did you?
We had a very healthy balance, Gordon, and I think that's what is important to note. But you were talking about Freddie Tuilagi. There was his brother Henry, the number 8, who was unfortunately injured for a lot of the time that I was there, so I didn't get to play with him as much as I would have wanted to. But my God, on a Tuesday, thankfully I was with him quite often, or if you weren't with him, you knew where to run or avoid running and things like that. So I think there's a bit made out of those Tuesday sessions. There was a load of scraps, but how productive they were at times, I don't know. But that was the Leicester way. And I know people in England were saying, well, listen, that's not the way English Premier League is, and Leicester's quite unique with that, but that's what it was built on. And we had Richard Cockerill as the coach, who had come through a system with those players that I had mentioned, so it was a formula for success. So who were you to question it? That's the way they did it,
and you bought into it as well. It doesn't matter what the system is or what the approach is, as long as everybody buys in.
Did Leinster lack that buy-in back in those days?
Yeah, I think Shane explained it really well, in that you had this quite big divide in the camp. It was there for everybody to see, but there wasn't any, you have to know what the problem is first. And I think it was only with a bit of looking back and maybe Cheka coming in and him identifying it from the outside to try to go, okay, well, we need to break this two-stroke sister or two-stroke team that we have going on here, because it's a clear divide within the team. So you kind of had one group buying into X, Y, and Z for the limited games they got, and then knowing that, well, when these Irish guys come back, they're just gonna take the roles.
So Shane, when you decided to come back after 2 years, I think you won a premiership title, didn't you, in your time there? You come back after 2 years. I mean, first of all, what prompted you to come back? And then secondly, had anything changed back in Dublin when you came back to Leinster?
Yeah, I think there was personal reasons in terms of my family. I wanted to be closer to my family, that I wanted to come home. I had no intention once I'd signed to come home within the 2 years, but thankfully the opportunity did come about where myself and Cheka met, and he offered me a contract, so I was delighted to come back. And there was noticeable change. And I think what I had mentioned earlier on with the guys looking at our biggest rivals winning competitions wasn't sitting well. I think there was a realization that they weren't the young amateurs anymore. They were experienced professionals, and that they wanted to have silverware to go along with their expertise. So the likes of that older peer group, like Brian, Gordon, Shane, and others, as well as that combination of younger guys like Jamie, Sean, Rob, these kind of guys coming through, it was a very, very powerful combination. And Cheka deserves a huge amount of credit, as does Mike Brewer, who was really, really good at the start with us as a pack, got us playing very, very well. John O'Gibbs coming in, we had good additions, like good people like Chris Whittaker, who came in from the outside, who was just a very good professional, but a great bloke as well. And then we had some good signings that the management had done. Like, there was people like Heinke van der Merwe, who had come in, who nobody really would have known or rated, but yet when it came to the big games, we had a bit of depth in our squad. So the combination of all that, but the fundamental was a bit of an attitude change, and that was driven by Cheka, and that was a work rate, that was a desire, and that led to standards improving. And then you see the likes of the real professionals like Johnny, who came through and made a name for himself, and he was driving standards. So there was the combination of, I think, players maturing, understand what it takes, what's involved, and then to be able to actually capitalize on it. And once you start winning one or two trophies, you get hungry for it and you get greedy for it, and that's a powerful combination. And I think that's what happened, and we certainly didn't want to relinquish that and give our biggest rivals or anybody else the opportunity to win any trophies.
The bit with that is, and you kind of mentioned all the like the players and the coaches that came in, and like, not that you've forgotten about Mike Brewer, but like, he was such a big character, but he's not talked about that often. And
was he forwards coach, was he?
Yeah. And the relationship he had with the forwards, like, geez, he often tried to create a divide between the forwards and backs. he was really important with what he, and complimented Cheka quite well. But there was also a big turnover in players, over that 2 year period where Shane was when Shane was in Leicester, and that was a lot of the hard work that Cheka did to try and go, okay, like he often made training so pointlessly tough that he wanted players to fail and then wanted to see who was come back and who would get back up. And it was his, I think he talks about Cheka, and I've talked to him about this since, and he said there was a mental fragility to Leinster that he wanted to change. And he said some of that was people, but he said a lot of it was attitude.
You know, that's bull in a china shop type attitude. Presumably a guy comes in and does that, there's a lot of people who kind of look and go, who the hell is this guy?
I don't think so. Well, Cheno can talk about when he met him, like Cheka sold me straight away. And
really?
It was just like, yeah. So you start going, like, what's the overarching thing here? It's like, it doesn't matter what the theme is, as long as people buy into it. So Cheka obviously got enough for Shane to come to buy into it. I bought into it from the moment I met him as well.
Is that fair enough, Shane? You were not so much hooked straight away, but you liked what he was selling you pretty quickly.
And he wasn't selling anything. It wasn't as if he was like some magic potion, you know what I mean? It was all very common sense. And I think what Gordon is talking to there, he was the hardest working guy in the organization. And like, nobody appreciates that when you talk about Leo as the head coach. Leo, the time they put in and all the time the coaches put in, players come in at whatever, 8 o'clock, and they're gone by 3:30 and they have a half day. Like, coaches don't do that. Coaches are working on whatever strategy needs to be done for the Saturday, but all the other items that are going on, trying to recruit players, trying to make sure that their coaching staff, he had a vision for Leinster, and, you know, he was a very, very smart, astute individual, and he knew how to work with people and get people. But his fundamental thing, I felt, was he was an angry, stubborn, chip in his shoulder Aussie that wanted to prove a point. And that's who we were. And he translated that for a guy who wasn't from Leinster to be able to impose that mentality and to develop guys with that just shows how good he was. You know, like, technically, he's not the greatest coach. There's better coaches, there was worse coaches, but his secret sauce was that and how he got players to buy in, and he got good people around him. And he's so... You know, he had a strategy. He says, I can get this team so far and then I'm going to have to go somewhere else. And he had the awareness to be able to do that. And he had a finite period of achieving it, and he did it. So that's why I think we all speak so highly of him, is because he had such an impact as an outsider. And he certainly developed my play, developed other people's play, but he just developed their actual understanding of the responsibility that goes with that. So that's a maturity thing. And, you know, it's pretty powerful to do that to a group of individuals. Like, it wasn't just one or two, like there was 30, 35 people that got that.
I think it's important is what that translates to in every day. So you have players like Leo and Shane, and now you have Sean O'Brien in there. You've got Brian, Shane Horgan, you know, Jamie Heasley, guys like this who are willing to, it's not always the negative, but it tends to be the negative, to pull other players up and say, actually, you kind of need to pull up your socks, or why are you behaving like that? Why are you doing that? That's not what we want. And then equally celebrating guys who did stuff well. And that's when the culture moves from being, you know, Cheka dictating to players actually going, okay. So then you compare that to, say, what Leicester had, you know, 3-4 years previous when Shane was there. So you're now getting that here where players are stumping up and going, actually, I have a responsibility to show up today.
Yeah, and it's a responsibility, I think, or an image of the province that's pretty much stuck since then. I know they had a couple of lean years when Cullen first got the head coach job, and they kind of brought through a new cycle of young players. There was 1 year they didn't get out of their pool in Europe. But basically, apart from that blip of a year or two, they've been, you know, quarterfinals, semifinals, finals, if not winning. Well, they've won, 2011, 2012, 2018. But they've been, you know, they've been that standard setter that Leicester were back in the day. I mean, first of all, is it any surprise that from 2007, 2009 onwards, that there has been that culture setting? And equally, is it surprising that, you know, Leicester haven't dropped, but, you know, they're not up at that top echelon maybe that they were back in when you were there, Shane?
Yeah, that's a difficult one to answer because I'm on the outside. I don't fully understand or appreciate the work. I know in and around 2009, the organization took huge leaps forward in terms of the other half of the building, not the playing side, but the kind of the operational side. So the likes of the marketing department, the likes of the various RDOs or whatever, regional development officers or whatever they were called, going out into the wider province and developing the game, developing the supporter base, how that took a lot of time to build up to what it is now. The school system, the youth system, the club system, you know. So the IRFU model, where I alluded to, it was different from England to Ireland. There's so much benefit to that in terms of the player pipeline that you're seeing and the conveyor belt of talent. Like Dublin and Leinster has a population of what compared to any other club in the world, you know, with what real professional competition. I know there's professional soccer, there's GAA, yes, but it's not professional. So that level of talent coming through, so that pipeline, I don't think many clubs have it, but it's a huge credit to the academies, the development officers in Leinster, how they're able to get that pipeline of talent coming through. And I don't know what the percentages are, what the ratios are, but how many people are actually from Leinster playing for Leinster versus other clubs around the world, you know? So that is a huge, huge benefit, where you have an innate want or desire to play for your hometown club. And if you have the opportunity, they'll facilitate that as best they can if you're delivering or whatever. So the level of work, dedication, time, investment, not just from Leinster, but the IRFU, I think has added to that. But if you don't have someone driving the bus like Leo at the start, it's not going to happen. So yes, he's unassuming and he'll be humble about it, but it usually boils down to the main fella at the top. And if he's doing it right, that does trickle down. Not always the case. I know it's somewhat contradictory when we're saying everybody else is involved, but it's the combination of it all.
Just as a quick follow-up before we go on that, I mean, you're talking about the lads want to stay and play for Leinster, and it's a conversation we've had, like, you know, guys like Max Deegan, who have got two internationals ahead of him and in another life could have had a very, very strong club career somewhere else where he's starting his whole career. Do you think that pull to stay and play for Leinster is much stronger now because you know you're probably going to get a good chance of getting medals, whereas maybe back when you left, that possibility, not certainty, because it's never a certainty you're going to win medals, but it was less likely back then that you, if you stayed and as a squad player, you'd get a medal back then than it is now?
Well, I guarantee if you ask any player, whether they're from Leinster, Munster, Ulster, Connacht, they want to play for their hometown province. Everybody wants to play for their hometown club. So that desire is there. And if it isn't there, then there's something wrong. But I think when you have the opportunity to be a part of a team that's successful, it multiplies that or it amplifies that. And that's what Leicester had. Like, you don't have many people turning down Toulouse, I'd say, do you? You know what I mean? Like, people want to play for the biggest clubs. They want to win things. And thankfully, Leinster, as an ex-Leinster player and a Leinster supporter, that's good to have. And that's the work that the previous generations would have done. I wanted to play for Leinster because of the previous generation. And that's what I hope we have done as part of our part of the Leinster club or our time that was there, that we've imposed that, you know, it's great to play for your club, but you have to win. And that's important. And that's not you have to win or else. It's no, this is what goes with it. And that attracts more players coming through that pipeline. And it just takes an awful lot of work because it can go very quickly. So that's why it's so impressive from the outside looking at what they're doing. But that's what makes it exciting as well, because Leicester have the same attitude. They may not be delivering on it as much as they had done in the past, but that's what they want to get back.
Yeah, and Leicester seem to have definitely gone back to their roots a little bit. And I know you talk about the right guy. I know Geordie did a huge, like, took an awful lot of pain in his short time as director of rugby there. But he started, again, going back to those principles of finding the right people. Razzie talks about that. South Africa, it's a lot of it is about getting the right people in the change room, and you can build an awful lot from there.
Right then, we'll leave it there. My thanks, as always, to Gordon and John O'Sullivan, who joined us earlier. And of course, particular thanks must go to Shane Jennings for his insights this week. You've been listening to the Counter Ruck podcast, brought to you by the Irish Times in association with Nifty Business. This episode was produced by John Casey. My name is Nathan Johns. Counter Ruck will be back next week.